On 881 WYPR, I'm Tom Hall. This is Maryland Morning. How will the not guilty verdict in the trial of Officer Edward Nero, combined with last year's hung jury in the case of Officer William Porter, affect the state's attorney's case against Cesar Goodson, whose trial is slated to begin early next month? He's the next Baltimore police officer to be tried in connection with the death of Freddie Gray. This morning, legal analysis from attorney Edward Smith and University of Baltimore law professor David Jaros. And a new multimedia website from ESPN explores the intersection between race, sports, and culture with investigative reporting and commentary from a staff of richly experienced writers, most of whom are African American. Michael Fletcher is one of those acclaimed journalists. He joins me to talk about The Undefeated. Plus, if you're headed outside this Memorial Day weekend, our resident foodie Sasha Wohlhandler has ideas about spicing up a picnic, and Tom Pelton puts the environment in focus. Maryland Morning starts right after these headlines.
I'm producer Rob Sivak. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Thanks, Nathan. Good morning, everybody. Welcome to Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us. Officer Edward Nero was the second of six officers to be tried in connection with the arrest and death of Freddie Gray last year. The 30-year-old former volunteer firefighter from New Jersey joined the Baltimore Police Department 4 years ago. He was one of three officers on bike patrol the morning of Freddie Gray's arrest. On Monday, Judge Barry Williams found him not guilty on four counts, including second-degree assault. So how will this verdict, along with the hung jury that resulted when Officer William Porter was tried late last year, affect the legal strategies of both the prosecution and defense as they move to the next trial, that of Officer Cesar Goodson, which is scheduled to begin a week from Monday? And what about that appeals court decision that was somewhat overshadowed by the end of the Nero trial? It was released last Friday, and it sheds light on what the Court of Appeals thinks about compelling officers to testify in each other's trials. So to explain all of this and offer their analysis, our legal eagles are back in Studio A this morning. Edward Smith is an attorney in private practice with experience as a defense lawyer and a prosecutor. David Jaros is on the faculty of the University of Baltimore School of Law. Gentlemen, always good to see you.
Always good to see you, Tom.
Good morning.
So, Eddie, let's start with you. You've had a couple of days to think about the verdict. You were with me here in the studio when the verdict was announced, and we announced it here on WYPR. But any thoughts now that, in the light of a couple of days?
Well, just like any journey, you're always glad to get to the location that you seek. Some of us didn't see this coming. Some of us did see it coming. But it's the end of a process and the beginning of another. So I think we all just need to look ahead and not look behind us. We don't need to be in a position where we allow others' expectations to determine our future or to determine exactly where we need to be. And so I'm hopeful again, and I believe that the things in Baltimore are going to proceed the way they should.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, expectations are one thing, Dave Jaros, but the law is another. Anything, when you read the opinion, when you read the transcript of what Judge Williams said from the bench, and you were in the courtroom when he read this statement in which he exonerated Officer Nero of all four counts against him, anything strike you as interesting?
There were some things that were particularly striking. This was a very complicated legal theory that the prosecution had for Officer Nero, and their argument about the assault was not related, in fact, to the very graphic video that caught the public's eye in this case, but was rather based on a theory that the police had lawfully detained Mr. Gray, but over the course of that detention, they were not vigorous enough in either confirming or dispelling their suspicion. And so that detention morphed into an arrest without probable cause. And as a result, the touching during that was an unlawful touching. And that was the basis of the assault charge. And I know that sounds complicated.
It sure does.
It does.
So the arrest itself necessarily wasn't unjustified. But then because they waited 2 or 3 minutes and sort of didn't justify why they had just stopped Mr. Gray, I mean, obviously, at least the reports have said that he sort of looked at him, strangely, and then took off. So they went after him. Nobody's contending that that's a bad thing, right? They're not even contending that stopping him is a bad thing, but they are contending that having stopped him, they should have done something different.
And I'll even be lawyerly with you and say, I'm not going to say whether or not it's a bad thing, because it's based on a case that I personally am not fond of, Illinois v. Wardlaw, but it was certainly legal to chase and detain Mr. Gray. The question is, how much force could they use and for how long could they detain him before they confirmed some kind of criminal suspicion? But what was really interesting about the verdict is I think many attorneys, many people watching the trial, thought that the judge would find that this was lawful for the police to do this. Instead, the judge decided on very narrow grounds that this particular officer, Officer Nero, was not the one who was touching Mr. Gray. And in fact, there's one line in his decision where he said the defendant, Mr. Nero, was not present when the detention morphed into an arrest. And that is significant for Officer Miller, who is charged with assault, who did touch Mr. Gray, who I think is arguing that this did not morph into an arrest until after the knife, which we heard very little about, was recovered later.
And of course, Edward Miller still is one of the four officers remaining to be tried. And then Officer Porter is going to be tried again. His trial ended in a hung jury. So and he was granted limited immunity.
He was.
So the stuff that came out about Mr. Miller's involvement in this incident, is that admissible in Miller's trial?
So nothing that Officer Miller said would be admissible in a trial against him, and even more so, nothing that was derived from his testimony, no questions based on what he said. So any of the state's attorney's office who heard this testimony really cannot be involved in his prosecution. And one sort of notable thing about that is Marilyn Mosby, our state's attorney, was in the room when Officer Miller testified. So I think that suggests she really cannot be involved in the prosecution's case against him.
Yeah, there's one caveat to that. If there's an independent source of the information under Castigar that did not result from the lips of Officer Miller, then, of course, the state's attorney's office can use that. And one wonders, of course, in deciding how to go about such a case and the analysis of where you get that independent information, where it's going to come from. It's possible that they do have something, and it's possible that they may not. It's possible that they held back on using one of the officers as a result of what one or more have said.
Castigar, we should remind folks, is a Supreme Court decision back in 1972, ruling on the issue of whether the government's grant of immunity can compel a witness to testify in a case. So they have announced, the prosecution has announced, that they're going to have different attorneys. It won't be Mr. Schatzkow and Ms. Bledsoe who have tried Officer Porter and Officer Nero. It's going to be somebody else trying Mr. Miller. But and that's because of what Dave is talking about here. If they were involved in this current proceeding, they can't be involved in the next one? Is that
well,
right?
No, that's not a hard and fast rule. There can be a firewall, and certainly it's best to have separate prosecutors. So I think that was very wise on behalf of the state's attorney's office. But there's nothing that prevents that as a rule, as long as you understand that you can't use something that comes out mm-hmm. of a defendant's lips in order to convict him.
Yeah, and then there's the whole thing about the judge who's heard all of this. That's interesting.
Yeah, the only other issue there is I think it's slightly more complicated because, remember, there can be no question asked that is based on what you learned during the course of the compelled testimony. So if Mr. Schatzkow, for example, were to be cross-examining Mr. Miller in his later trial, we'd have to be concerned about whether or not he's asking questions based on what he knows Miller had testified to. So that's why they have to create this wall that Mr. Schmidt is talking about.
It is complicated. My Lord, Dave Jaros from the University of Baltimore and Ed Smith, an attorney here in private practice in Baltimore. You're listening to Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. So, Ed, in the Porter trial, 11-1 of that people on that jury voted in favor of acquittal on the involuntary manslaughter charge. 8-2, according to a juror who spoke anonymously to the Baltimore Sun, voted in favor of acquittal on the second-degree assault charge. So there are two counts in which the jury seemed to lean towards acquittal, although they were not able to acquit him. And then the other two were split, one 7-3, the other 10-1, on misconduct in office and reckless endangerment. Knowing that, knowing how close the jury came, because they were one vote away from acquitting him on involuntary manslaughter, knowing that the judge, Williams, Judge Williams, has completely exonerated Officer Nero, What happens in Officer Goodson's case? He's the next to be tried on the 6th of June.
He starts all over, fresh. And that's the way it should be, with jurors who will not be biased by what occurred and what the numbers were in the first jury. And remember, you're only close in horseshoes. The deal is that either you get a ringer or you don't.
Yeah.
And the deal is that when you start all over, you get a fresh breath of everything. Mm-hmm. So I don't think that that's going to have any impact if voir dire is handled correctly, if people tell the truth about what they know, and if they can't find a jury who is unbiased, then they'll start all over again or they'll leave the jurisdiction.
Mm-hmm. And Dave, I mean, do you think this will influence the strategy that the prosecution will use against Officer Goodson or the defense for that matter?
Well, there's two different trials here. If we're talking about Officer Nero's case, he was charged with reckless endangerment for failing to buckle in Mr. Gray. If you look at what the judge actually said in the case, one of the reasons why he said Officer Nero did not act unreasonably is because he could expect that perhaps Officer Goodson or Lieutenant Rice, who was in the van, was the one who was responsible for Mr. Gray. So I think he actually crafted a decision that very much doesn't tell us what he thinks about Officer Goodson if this were a bench trial. And of course, if it's a jury trial, I think Ed's absolutely right. You have a new jury and it's a new day.
Yeah, and we don't know at this point whether or not Officer Goodson will opt with what Officer Nero did, which is to say, I want a bench trial instead of a jury trial. He is charged with second degree, this is Officer Goodson we're talking about, charged with second degree depraved heart murder. Ed Smith, what does that mean?
Well, it means a lot of trouble. That's what it means. And it means a heavy sentence. So what it means is that you've done something intentionally that caused the death of somebody, or you've done something that's absolutely grossly negligent that caused the death of someone. I mean, that's bottom line what mm-hmm. it means. And
Dave, he's also charged with second degree assault, manslaughter by vehicle. I mean, are these really difficult things to prove?
They are, particularly the depraved heart murder. I mean, Ed is right that this is, you know, the part about depraved heart murder that's important is this is the kind of wanton and reckless disregard for human life that, you know, they talk about it being viciousness or contemptuous of human life. The example I use in my class is students throwing concrete blocks off of the top of our building into a crowd of people below where they're not aiming for anyone in particular. They don't have the intent to kill.
But they know that bad things are going to happen.
Equals basically the intent to kill, so it's so malicious.
Right.
So this is an incredibly hard hard case for them to prove. Lesser includeds are possible.
All right, we got to call it quits there. We once again did not get to talk too much about the appeals court ruling. I swear one of these days we will. I appreciate
well, they
you
know
guys.
What they said.
Appreciate you guys coming in. Attorney Ed Smith and University of Baltimore School of Law Professor Dave Jaros providing legal analysis here on Maryland Morning as the trials and the officers indicted in connection with the address and death of Freddie Gray proceeds. Stay tuned to WIPR for complete coverage of all the trials. Officer Caesar Goodson goes on trial June 6th. Coming up after a break for the news, a new web platform from ESPN looks at the world through the prism of sports. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
If you want to join in on the conversation, go to our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning, and make a comment. We'd love to hear from you. You can also check out our audio archives there and learn more about what you just heard, or even make a pledge to support local programming. Again, that's at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
Maya Angelou once wrote, "You may encounter many defeats, but you must not be defeated. In fact, it may be necessary to encounter the defeats so you can know who you are, what you can rise from, and how you can still come out of it." The inspiration for ESPN's new web-based platform is inspired by Maya Angelou. It's called The Undefeated, and it explores the intersection between race, sports, and culture. My next guest is one of the seasoned writers who make up the largely African-American staff of this new endeavor, the journalist and author Michael Fletcher. He's worked as a reporter at the Baltimore Sun and the Washington Post. also co-authored a book about Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas. One thing he's never done is be a sports reporter, but now here he is working for ESPN and sitting right here with me in Studio A. Mike, it's good to see you.
Good to be back, Tom.
So the Undefeated, tell us about, for folks who haven't wandered over there on the web, tell us what's involved.
Well, it's a bit as you describe. It's a new sort of portal, I think of it as, for ESPN that's going to cover the intersection of race, sports, and culture. And most of the stories will have some sports element, but not every one of them. And the idea is that ESPN is trying to get sort of new ideas into its front door, and hopefully some of these ideas will migrate to even other ESPN platforms. So if there's a particularly compelling piece that we come up with for The Undefeated, perhaps it could become a 30 for 30, or perhaps it could become an ESPN short film. And again, not necessarily all sports things. It's kind of the direction ESPN has been moving into. Some of your listeners may be familiar with 538, the Nate Silver site.
Nate Silver, who he came from the New York Times.
Came from the New York Times, went to ESPN, exactly. Right. And 538 is kind of our sister site, if you will. And they sort of do data journalism, a lot of it around sports, but a lot of it around other issues, politics, economics. So this is ESPN's attempt to sort of leverage the huge audience they have for sports and get them into other issues. And for us, there's no more important issue, I think, particularly right now, than race. You can't have sort of too much coverage of that, I think, and particularly thoughtful coverage. We're not looking to do just sort of hot takes and commentary, mm-hmm. and there'll be some of that, of course.
Yeah, because when you talk about the intersection between race, sports, and culture, it dawns on me that race intersects with everything.
Exactly.
There's just nothing it doesn't intersect with.
And
for that matter, maybe culture, too, I guess.
Yeah, exactly, and in amazing ways in this country, because when it intersects, it changes everything. Name the issue, and then you add that element of race, all of a sudden you have a different conversation, whether it's home ownership, wealth development, educational attainment, go on and on and on. Race complicates that because obviously this country is so freighted by its racial history.
Yeah. So. And it's interesting that you're obviously, because it's on the web, you can click through all sorts of things. For example, you're involved in a conversation that was posted last night about 5 o'clock with Farai Chidea and Nate Silver on the 538 spot, which I got to because I was looking at The Undefeated. And Clinton Yates wrote a column about the Freddie Gray trial, and then there were some other sort of news items. And there was a thing that says, Mike Fletcher is talking about Obama and Reverend Jeremiah Wright,
right.
In a conversation on 538. And you click on that, and all of a sudden you're off The Undefeated, and you're on the 538 spot, right? Is this it seems to be an attempt, particularly to attract African-American viewers, African-American clickers, in a way that have not been attracted in the past. Is that
fair? I think that's absolutely right. I think that's kind of the business sort of idea here. ESPN, as I'm learning, over-indexes among African-American viewers on television.
Over-indexes? What does that
meaning
mean?
That if African-Americans are 12% of the population, we account for 16, 17, 18% of the TV audience. But digitally, it's the opposite. We are underrepresented among the digital audience. So the idea here is to try to build some content that will draw more Black viewers, particularly, and everyone hopefully, but more Black viewers to ESPN's digital offerings. And obviously, the world is moving to streaming everything, and everything's converging on digital. So I think that's a key component for ESPN's future.
Michael Fletcher is a senior writer at The Undefeated, a new web platform which was launched a couple of weeks ago from ESPN. You are a very experienced journalist. You're with the Washington Post, a hugely influential and significant media platform. You're a co-author of the Clarence Thomas book. Kevin Merida was the first African-American managing editor of the Washington Post. He's now with The Undefeated at ESPN. There is a staff of, I think it's 40-something folks.
Right, about 40. Yeah.
And some very prominent journalists. I mean, it had to be quite a decision for you and Kevin and others to say, yes. Okay, we want you to leave the Washington Post, of all places, and come to this brand new startup.
Oh, you should have my wife here to describe
I would love to talk to her about that. As a matter
of fact, the deliberations at our house. You know, but at the end of the day, and as you mentioned, I spent many years, 13 years at The Sun, over 20 years at The Washington Post, and enjoyed every minute of it. And The Post was, you know, is doing well right now, has a lot of money pumped into it by Jeff Bezos, and is doing some exciting things digitally and otherwise. But at the end of the day, that opportunity to work for a site with this kind of mission was just too good to pass up. And with the kind of support that ESPN can provide, one of the editors at The Post joked, and she wasn't wrong, that this is like a startup, but with a safety net and also with, you know, with a lot of kind of institutional support. So it felt like an exciting sort of opportunity and possibility. And I don't have that many more laps around the track left in my career. So I thought, hey, this is the moment to try to do something different. If I don't do this, what would it be? And it would be no shame in staying at the Post for the rest of my career. But it felt like that kind of decision.
Yeah. So. I mean, you've been in the business a long time.
Yes.
And when you entered the business, there were a lot fewer African-Americans in the business than there are now.
Yeah.
But still, I mean, just as you look at the scope of your career heretofore, and now in the context of this new venture in which the newsroom, which is kind of virtual, I mean, you're living here in Baltimore, right. You know, and the other people are living in other places. Have black journalists been marginalized, and are they less marginalized now? Is this a statement, a manifestation of the end of marginalization of black journalists?
I don't know. You know, journalism has just changed so much. I think, you know, after many years of kind of the goal being in for a journalist to get to a big institution like the Post or the Sun, you've had this kind of democratization of journalism. So now you have a lot of celebrity journalists. You sort of can build your own brand. Everyone's kind of, the digital world means that you don't need to have necessarily a big institution behind you to sort of make a name for yourself. But and a lot of the big institutions have been cutting back. But in that, a lot of African-American and other journalists as well have lost jobs. So now it's kind of a new landscape. And it's the big name, whatever newspaper, as we used to say, is not necessarily the ticket to prominence. I mean, it's still very important. And here at Undefeated, I'm working now on a series of essays about President Obama. And it's an opportunity that I would have at the Post, but not in the same way. We're going to sort of look at Obama's legacy, but not through the traditional lens of, say, you know, what he did with national security. You know, should he have moved that red line in Syria or not? But sort of looking at race, sports and culture in many ways. How has the first black president changed this country? How perhaps was he treated differently than other presidents? How did he sort of change what we perceive as mainstream culture in America? So it feels like the kind of thing where essentially it's fun, right?
Yeah.
And it's essentially, it gives you a sort of a novel way of thinking about the presidency and looking at the impact he's made.
And of course, this particular president happens to be a big sports fan, was a basketball player, at least when he started in office. I think maybe he's now
more of a golfer, like so many of us.
Yeah, right. And that's an age-appropriate thing, as we say. but you know, other than, you know, it's good that you're at this moment, you're not writing about George H.W. Bush, you know, who just wasn't all that closely affiliated with sports. But I even heard that you're hoping that perhaps President Obama post-presidency would be a contributor to the Undefeated.
Oh, yeah, we'll be praying on that one.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
That would be great. It feels the kind of place he would want to contribute to.
Yeah, I mean, it does have that kind of feel. It's interesting. Some of the pieces that are currently posted are really thoughtful. There's a guy named Mike Wise who's talking about this latest poll of Native Americans who seem to say the name of the team in Washington, which I'm loath to say on the air, is not all that offensive, and you know, people shouldn't worry about it, and it's okay if that name stays. And of course, Mr. Snyder, the owner of the Redskins, is going to use this poll to bolster his thing. But he raises the specter. He says, you know, should a poll influence a moral decision?
Right.
And I thought that was a perfect exemplar of what you're talking about, how this prism of sports can talk about larger issues.
No, I think you're absolutely right. And if you think about sports history, I mean, sports has been kind of a one place where I think America has kind of wrestled with their racial issues and resolved things. You think of all Jackie Robinson went through. I mean, that's the most classic case, but there are other people, Perry Wallace, the first basketball player in the Southeast Conference. As a matter of fact, I talked to him in connection with my Obama piece that will be coming out probably next week. It's interesting how keenly he watched the president and how many parallels he saw between the president's experience and his own
and his
experience,
own.
Yeah, in the 60s, playing for Vanderbilt University and going to Starksville, Mississippi, and wherever else, you know, traveling that circuit to play ball. And now we turn the TV on and, you know, Kentucky, you know, black ball players all over the Southeast Conference. But not that long ago, well, maybe for some, but not for me, not that long ago, that was, you know, a revolutionary thing.
One of the pieces, and it seems to me that when we have this prism of race, when we talk about race, sports, and culture, it's a little dicey in avoiding what I can only refer to as profiling. And by that, I mean this. For example, there's a piece by another Washington Post vet, Michael Wilbone, about advanced analytics in sports. Mm-hmm. And the premise of his piece is that African-Americans tend to care less about the analytics. This is the sort of money ball stuff Michael Lewis was writing about. So, you know, all these Harvard MBAs are figuring out who the best first baseman is going to be, you know, based on all these stats.
Right, right.
And, of course, ESPN is just a stat-filled, you know, wonderland for people who are into all that stuff. But he's saying, you know, black folk don't really care that much about that. They don't make their decisions about who's good and who's not so good based on that kind of analytic. They do it from the heart. They do it more viscerally. Mm-hmm. I just wonder if that borders on saying, you know, there's this monolithic, notion of how African Americans look at it and how Caucasians.
Well, and I think that's a danger. But I think we have a diverse enough staff that, you know, over time you'll see all kinds of points of view, all kinds of opinions. And one of our goals is to kind of reflect just kind of the diversity of black thought, black opinion. We'll weigh in more on Freddie Gray. Right. You know, people talk about the black community, but, you know, the three black cops charged in the Freddie Gray case, they're part of the black community as well. I mean, it's sort of how do they fit into that equation? So I think we'll be in a unique position to sort of parse some of that and to sort of just reflect the complexity that I think that we hear discussed over our kitchen tables, you know, with our friends when we go to dinner and everything else. There's no monolith out there. Sometimes it gets portrayed that way, but there certainly isn't. And I think one of our goals is to sort of make that apparent through our coverage.
Mm-hmm. There was a site on ESPN called Grantland back in October of 2015. It was discontinued. It strikes some people as being a kind of a similar venture. Of course, that one didn't succeed. I mean, are there things that do you think ESPN learned from Grantland? Did you all study Grantland and think about it when you, because you took 3 or so years to launch this thing. You've thought about this for a while.
Well, yeah, other people were in charge in launching it. You know, I came aboard in January, and Kevin, I believe, started in October or November. And Grantland is one of the questions I had when I was kind of going through my deliberation. But ESPN says, and I've come to believe, you know, the executives there, that Grantland really was disbanded, not because it wasn't successful. It's because the guy who was in charge of it left, and a number of his deputies left with him. And another thing that I think caused some unease was that Grantland, it was sort of run as separate from ESPN. And the leadership of Grantland felt like we don't need to be sort of, quote unquote, poisoned by Bristol, you know, by the mothership. We're going to kind of run our own deal.
Bristol, Connecticut, where ESPN
is based. Headquarters.
But no, Undefeated is fully.
We want to be fully integrated. Absolutely. We see it as like we want to take advantage of what ESPN can offer us and, you know, and sort of use that to elevate our journalism.
Yeah, well, this is well worth the trip over online. And we'll, of course, have a link to it on our website. So, Mike, good luck and break a leg with this. This is going to be fun to follow.
Well, thanks for having me, Tom.
Michael Fletcher, he's a senior writer at ESPN's new digital platform, The Undefeated, which explores the intersection of race, sports, and culture. As I said, we'll have a link to The Undefeated on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Coming up after a break for the news, the rain has ended. Spring is finally in the air. Our resident foodie, Sasha Wohlhandler, is on the way with everything we need to know about cooking up the perfect picnic. But first, it's time for The Environment in Focus.
If you want to join in on the conversation, go to our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning, and make a comment. We'd love to hear from you. You can also check out our audio archives there and learn more about what you just heard, or even make a pledge to support local programming. Again, that's at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
On 88.1 WYPR, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. It's time now for What You Got Cooking.
Say, hey, good looking. What you got cooking? How's about cooking something up with me?
With the Memorial Day weekend coming up, we mark the unofficial start of summer. Our resident foodie, Sasha Wollhandler, is here. Sasha and her husband, Steve Susser, run Sasha's 527 Restaurant and Catering on Charles Street in Baltimore. Hey, Sasha, how you doing?
Hey, Tom, how are you?
Doing great. So great. Summer is upon us. So let's talk a little bit about tips for a great summer picnic.
Well, yes. I mean, nothing brings together senses and brightens the spirit like a picnic. It's just so free. You know, you're running, you're jumping. As Wordsworth said, splendor in the grass, glory in the flowers. And off we go to a picnic, Tom. What's your picnic
splendor
memory?
Splendor in the grass, indeed. When I was a student at Tanglewood, we used to bring a little dinner out on the lawn and under the stars, listen to the Boston Symphony, and yes, a little smooching, a little sipping. It was a very, very nice time. Very nice time. So there's a bunch of stuff we got to keep cognizant of when we have a picnic. First of all, you got to package all this food in a safe way. I mean, if you got hot food or cold food and you're taking it out into the middle of a field somewhere, you got to be careful.
Ice packs. Definitely ice packs. Don't put a bunch of ice cubes in a plastic bag. Get those little ice packs that you get at your local grocery. They're much more helpful, and then you could just refreeze them again, and they don't get all that wetness all over your food. So that's a really great way to go, rather than the bag full of ice cubes. And multitask your drinks. Freeze your water. It acts as an ice pack, and this is perfect for cooling items and bringing yourself some cold water. To that point, you want to also flavor your waters. Put cucumbers, mint, watermelon. It all gives water, and you've got a great drink and an ice pack as well.
Of course, fruit. Lots of fruits freeze nicely.
Fruits work wonderfully. Grapes freeze marvelously. So do peaches and mangoes. And then they just slither ice cold down a hot day down your throat. It's wonderful. Or put them in some red wine if you got instant sangria. Don't forget about frozen iced tea, lemonade, iced coffee. They all freeze wonderfully. And again, multitasking works well for you.
Yeah, so they keep the food warm or cold, rather, while you're in transit, and then they melt and you can drink them. Okay.
Exactly.
You got to be careful about what you take, because again, you don't want to be schlepping too much stuff. So like utensils and stuff like that, you got to be economical.
While we're not climbing Mount Everest, again, think of what you're carrying with you. A checkered tablecloth always adds an element of fun. Mason jars, while they're a little heavy, they work as a wonderful carrier and are very attractive for all kinds of salads. And don't forget that wine key. How many of us have been at a picnic in the middle of nowhere and can't get the bottle of wine open? It drives you crazy. And garbage bags. Whatever you take, folks, bring it back. Respect nature.
That's right. Leave it as you found it. Of course, sandwiches are something you're always going to bring on a picnic.
They are instantly portable and so delicious. When you think of bread, and I know we're all watching our carbohydrate intake, however, once in a while, it's great to just dive in and eat some carbs. And there are, you know, we've both seen at the farmer's market, they're wonderful rosemary breads and olive breads and walnut breads and raisin breads, and they're great vehicles for doing a wonderful sandwich.
Yeah, you know, paninis and wraps and all that kind of stuff. So give us a couple of funky sandwich ideas.
Well, the pan beignet is the French favorite. It's tuna fish, chunks of tuna, artichokes, tomatoes, capers, olives, and put that in a great vinaigrette. Put that in a hard-crusted bread, and it marinates in some of the bread. It is delicious. A little hard-boiled egg in there as well. Prosciutto and pesto mascarpone and fresh basil and sun-dried tomatoes.
Ooh, that's a good combo.
Or fresh tomatoes. You're sitting in the Tuscan sun with that one. American egg salad. Who doesn't love egg salad? But combine some red onion cream cheese with it and then put some caviar on it. Pull out the Prosecco with that one, Tom.
Caviar on egg salad.
Delicious.
That sounds like East meets West. Okay. How about flank steak? That's always makes a good
steak. Flank steak or any kind of steak. You've got some cold steak left over. Smother that with some sauteed mushrooms and some horseradish dressing. That is terrific. Hummus, roasted carrots, roasted zucchini, tomatoes. Wouldn't that be a wonderful vegetarian sandwich? So, and you can do wraps, everything, and they carry easily.
Yeah, and the other idea you have is to make stuff on skewers. I mean, for example, flank steak, you can put that on there. With you brought some examples in this morning. You got flank steak and some mushrooms and some scallions. That's delicious. And, of course, if it's on a skewer, you don't need a fork.
Exactly. And the other one I brought, I've got a whole roasted veggie one that we've got tomatoes and we've got carrots and we've got zucchini. I have another one that would work well on a Mexican picnic. That's some lime cilantro grilled chicken, and I've got that with some vegetables. And then, of course, some grilled shrimp and pineapple or mango. That would be a wonderful picnic treat to take. So all of the skewers, and once again, completely portable.
Yeah,
you can take a salad on a skewer if you have all your vegetables there. That's really on a skewer.
Yeah, so you've got sandwiches, you've got stuff on skewers. Of course, there's lots of different themes that you can follow for picnics. You can go international any number of ways.
We've got all kinds. Well, first, if we're going to go with the all-American picnic, everyone loves fried chicken, or you can do a rotisserie chicken that you can get. You can do roasted chicken. I like to take Parmesan mustard chicken tenders. I take the plain chicken breast. I cut them into tenders. Everybody knows how to do that. We put a little poupon mustard, and then I use that Japanese panko breadcrumbs, and I season that up with some dried garlic, and I put in thyme and oregano and a bunch of Parmesan. And then I roll my chicken first in the mustard, then roll it in that panko, fry it on both sides just to get it kind of golden brown, stick it in the oven for 5 to 7 minutes, and it's done. And you've got delicious chicken tenders, folks. That is so great.
My mom makes that, actually, something very close to that, and they're delicious. I can vouch for
that. And they travel so wonderfully.
Yeah.
Again, you don't even need a stick.
You can
just pick that up.
Pick them
up. But speaking of sticks, how about some corn pops? That's where we take a whole ear of corn, we cut it into thirds, we grill it or we boil it, and then I'm going to roll it in some spicy oil or some chipotle mayonnaise or any mayonnaise that you'd like, or the oil if you want to eliminate the mayonnaise, and then roll that into some crumbled goat cheese or crumbled blue cheese and add some scallions. You've got a whole crust. The corn gets cold, but it is like a cold corn salad on a skewer. It is wonderful.
Yeah, again,
so delicious.
No fork required. That's great. How about some other international themes for our picnic?
How about a Greek picnic? We've got dolmas, which you can get dolmas prepared many places, which are delicious. Take a pita and fill that with grilled chicken, tomatoes, cucumbers, tzatziki sauce. Again, use one of those skewers of grilled vegetables I talked about earlier, or a skewer of grilled shrimp and pineapple. You'll feel as if you're sitting on the coast of Santorini.
Even if you're down at Fort McHenry looking at the water.
You are. And we want to talk about wonderful places to have picnics. I mean, just going back for a minute, folks, you could put together an Asian picnic. You could put together a Mexican picnic. And we'll put some menus for that. But we want to talk about great places in Baltimore. We are so lucky here in Baltimore. We've got the gorgeous Fort McHenry. We've got Patterson Park. We have Druid Hill Park, which has so many beautiful, beautiful areas to lay out your checkered tablecloth. We've got Tindeco and many more. All I'm saying, Tom, grab a bottle of wine, a hunk of cheese, your favorite person, bask in the sunset, and always remember splendor in the grass.
Splendor in the grass. You are quick to remind us of that, Sasha. Okay, always great to see you. And, of course, in addition to the great places in Baltimore, there are terrific places in Annapolis and in Frederick and in Hagerstown and on all sorts of spots around the state in our listening area. Good to see you, Sasha.
Great to see you, Tom. Happy Memorial Day.
Thank you. You too. Sasha Wollhandler and her husband, Steve Susser, own Sasha's 527 Restaurant and Catering on Charles Street in Baltimore. Come to our website, WIPR.org/Maryland Morning, for lists of menus and a couple of recipes that we talked about this morning. That's it for us today. Coming up Friday morning on Maryland Morning, a conversation about the Civilian Review Board that is in place to provide oversight of the Baltimore City Police Department, plus Dr. Monica Lopez-Gonzalez. She's a cognitive scientist and a theater artist. We'll talk about her new theater piece and how science informs her art. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great day.